first thing that I notice is that the language is much stronger than I think that we've heard from either MRT or the diocese. There's been acknowledged outrage from both sides about sexual abuse by clergy and so forth. But I mean, the language throughout this document seems to express enormous anger. You talk about a significant erosion of trust. Maybe you could comment about that first, please.
I think that's absolutely accurate. And what we found in working with the 150 or so people who participated in this process was that a sense of outrage, frustration, and disappointment over what had occurred here. I would say that the positive part of that was they were willing to channel that into constructive recommendations for making the situation better. And so this report reflects a passion about the topics, and I think it demonstrates a love for the church and a love for the faith. When we saw these reports originally and read through them, there was something about that passion that came through that I concluded the bishop needed to see this in its unvarnished form and to understand what people were feeling. So the laity have spoken, and I think this reflects what I think has been the general sentiment out there, but now it's here in writing from a group of people who have actually studied the situation.
It is still very early in the process, but to what extent is it a concern that the diocese itself has not, to many, expressed that same level of outrage?
Well, I suppose we can debate that issue as to whether they have or they haven't. I think, you know, in my interactions with the bishop and in my just general observations, I think they have acknowledged the shortcomings. Whether they have done that sufficiently to indicate to both the faithful and especially to the victims of sexual abuse that they really understand what has happened and that they understand how serious it is, I understand why people might think that they haven't. But on page 4 of the report, we told the bishop about those common themes when we first met with him in early March, and we laid that right on the table and said, this is what we think is being experienced in the pews and out there among the faithful. And, I mean, he understood that, and he accepted that.
And he has talked about his willingness to work with MRT and Leadership Roundtable. That's also been brought in to facilitate this action. I think back to a question that I asked when you guys came into the studio. I was talking about how many have complained about the complete transparency of and the criteria that the diocese is using to put priests on the list of those who have had substantiated allegations of abuse, and all he said was, we're working on that.
Group 1's report in this document, there is a specific recommendation that the diocese adopt the Archdiocese of Boston reporting format. And that actually is something that has been discussed by the Joint Implementation Team, and there are some good aspects of the Archdiocese of Boston, and then there are some other things about it that Bishop Malone does not believe it even goes as far as what we're willing to do. So we have been working with the diocese on and going about that whole task differently, and it's taken a little time. But we have a format, actually one that has been used by the Jesuits Northeast Province, that is, I think, more complete in its disclosure. Whether it would get to complete transparency, as some may define that term, I don't know, but it would be more transparent than it is right now.
And could we talk a little bit more about that? Because I think this is, you know, one of the main areas that people are most concerned about and most anxious to get progress on. The work group's report actually is quite extensive on the multiple avenues being implemented. Transparency about the crisis, about finances and so forth, that's very strong language.
Well, it is. Okay, so let's talk about complete financial transparency. I mean, that was part of Group 2's report. They've made that recommendation. You know, whether we get there or not, I think is under discussion right now by the Finance Council, being chaired by Jim Biardi. I acknowledge that it is strong language, and, you know, in the scheme of things, that might not be possible. But the members of that work group felt strongly that they should stake out that territory and say, people want to know that everything has been disclosed, and we're going to try to work toward that. And it's important to keep in mind that this report really exists as a framework for discussion between the MRT and the diocese as it's playing out through the joint implementation team. So, you know, each one of these recommendations has to be taken on. We have to say to ourselves, how would we address this, and who needs to be consulted, and what are the pros and cons of going a particular way, and then to see whether we could get something put in place that would be acceptable. And that's what we're trying to do. And the good news, again, is that the bishop has been very open to putting things on the table and allowing us to address them. So we're hopeful on that. But I confess that when I saw complete financial transparency, I suspected that, well, we probably would never get to a point where it would be complete. But I think we want more financial transparency than what we have right now.
The organizing committee has recommended a foundational recommendation that the bishop look at all bodies that consult with the diocese, including the Diocesan Review Board. Now, we've tried to talk with those folks as well, or to get more information about the review board and how it works, and you know, what its procedures are through the diocese, too. It's been kind of a closed subject.
On the issue of the review board, you know, there is some strong language in Group 1's report. I would say that Group 1 did not have access to the review board when it was preparing its report, and there are perceptions or maybe concerns about the way the review board operates. Since the report was written, members of MRT have been meeting periodically with members of the Diocesan Review Board. We stressed, for example, the need to describe it as independent, because there was some concern that, was this controlled by the diocese, and are you really getting a truly independent look at an allegation of sexual abuse? Our impression to date is that that process is working reasonably well. We have independent people who are making the call on these cases. And as with most things like this, people may not always agree with their decisions, but I don't think that the decisions are being unduly influenced by, say, concerns over the church's reputation, as opposed to getting at the truth and delivering justice to victims. So that's actually an area where I'm not sure what we're going to come out with in terms of anything formal in the way of an action item, but we have been looking at this, and I feel better about that than I think some of the members of Group 1 felt about when they were preparing the report.
So could you expand on that a little bit? Because I think there's a lot of our listeners who are interested in what your understanding is of how the review board works.
Yeah, so it is chaired by Judge Sal Martocci, who I think has unquestionable ethics and integrity and a very good reputation in this community. The members of the review board, there's been an effort there to bring on people who have some background in trauma-informed cases. I think of Sister Mary McCarrick and Dr. Jack Coyne as being two such people on that review board. The review board is meeting regularly. It is processing cases involving allegations of sexual abuse. It is hearing directly from the diocesan investigator, Steve Halter, and people working with Steve on those to get to the bottom of it. The review board is guided to an extent by legal counsel for the diocese, but they don't make the decisions and they don't dictate the results. And the bishop doesn't control the review board. I've known Judge Martocci a long time, and I'm assured that he would not be serving in that role if it was not an independent review board. So it's what's called for under the Dallas Charter of 2002, and that is actually in place and operating. Now, whether it's moving fast enough or not, you know, some people complain about the cases dragging. I don't think that's the review board's issue, from what I understand. It may be an issue of resources devoted to the investigation of the cases, but the review board is spending a lot of time and effort in its meetings, and so I personally feel that's one of the things that's working well here.
When you and the bishop were here in studio talking, the bishop did mention that there's Halter, the former FBI agent in charge, plus a couple of former assistant DAs. But there are at least a couple of priests that I remember that an investigation has been going on for over a year. You think that is a question of resources? In part, at least?
In part, yeah, in part. To be honest, as I look at it, I guess as a lawyer, and just generally, I think the cases should be addressed more expeditiously, and that means getting the investigation complete and getting it before the review board. And I think I suspect that Judge Martocci would agree with that.
Yeah. Maybe there might be some additional resources designated for that in the future.
That may be a recommendation that we bring forward through the joint implementation team.
Another thing that caught my eye in particular was a couple of foundational themes. One, to voluntarily delegate greater authority to the bodies in the diocese, which include clerical and religious and laity, and then also embrace the opportunity to act voluntarily now, which of course brings up the question, if not voluntarily now, then what?
Let me address that first. Embracing the opportunity to act voluntarily now, bishops are given a pretty wide latitude as to things that they might do within their diocese. And we pointed out to him that there were things going on around the country and other dioceses where the bishops were not waiting for a directive from the Vatican or a decision by the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. And we suggested that there may be some best practices there. One was, and this has now been rendered moot because there is a directive, but one was this setting up a mechanism to process complaints against the bishop. You know, and that was a shortcoming of the Dallas Charter. If there was a complaint of sexual abuse against the bishop, there was no place to report that. And there was a bishop out in Missouri that we were aware of that had set up a mechanism where, in essence, the report, he was not in St. Louis, so the report was to be made to the review board in St. Louis for processing. He did that on his own. He had the ability to do it on his own. And we suggested to Bishop Malone, rather than, you know, constantly waiting for the Vatican to get around to it, do it now and show that you're acting independently. There will be some other opportunities to do that along the way. I don't have that was the first one that we were looking at. And in the meantime, at their most recent meeting in Baltimore, the bishops decided to put that in place. So that's not one of those areas. We're going to do this anyway. But we're urging him to think creatively about best practices and to show that he's willing to stake out some new territory. And that's where Leadership Roundtable's involvement is so important, because they have that national perspective of what's being done in other places and what seems to be working. And he's embraced that as a general principle. Now, the question is the specifics of that and how that might play out in particular areas.
However, the only person, the only place that can do anything about a bishop as far as removal or something that extreme is the Vatican, correct?
Well, the Vatican, but remember that the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops' action was in response to a directive by the Pope. And so this mechanism has been set up. And if, for example, involving a bishop in Buffalo, if there was a complaint made to the Archdiocese of New York and it ended up on Cardinal Dolan's desk, and he had a recommendation, because this has been set up at the direction of the Pope, I've got to believe that the Pope is willing to act on those recommendations. The significance of that action is that the matters will be addressed at a more local level, and I think people see these things getting pulled up into the Vatican, and then they seem to get lost, and the process is very murky to people, and they're not sure how these things happen. And sometimes the Vatican moves decisively. For example, they've just replaced a bishop in West Virginia and named a new bishop, and that moved pretty quickly, but that was a pretty egregious case. But I think people are looking at cases like that and say, does this really need to be sent to the Vatican to be adjudicated, or could the fact-finding occur more locally and have the decision just more or less ratified by the Vatican?
At what point here in Buffalo would that ever become a possibility or a desire?
To be honest, I think the bishops are trying to address the situation that arose with Cardinal McCarrick, where people seemingly turned a blind eye to some actions that were, I guess, more commonly known than people knew, and he continued to be promoted, and there was not an effective place to complain about a bishop who himself was engaging in sexual abuse.
Yeah, and it seems that it has to rise to that level, though, that the conference resolution would even come into play. That's what I'm saying. I mean, the bishop could reject this whole process, and it still wouldn't rise to that level.
I mean, it's true, Marian. He could reject it, but the good news is that he hasn't.
Where you think that this is going to lead? Anything else that we should be talking about this report as far as our listeners go? The bishop has had this since March.
Right, and so the joint implementation team has had a full agenda, and what's happening is we in the MRT have been bringing things forward for the agenda, and then there is some discussion and there's an agreement on things that are going to happen. We have introduced the team to, I think, pretty standard accountability measures. So we have an action register and a decision log. We record every decision that we make, when we made it, and why we made it. And then we have an action register of who's going to do what and by when. And then we try to follow up at subsequent meetings. Did we get those things done? And if not, you know, where do they stand? And if they have to be tweaked, then we keep doing that. So we're dealing with a small number of people, and progress is a little slow, but there is tremendous goodwill on the team. And frankly, as Leadership Roundtable looks at what's happening here, and I think you discovered this in your own reporting, what's happening here is significant in the life of the church. Even though it may not be moving at the speed that we might want it to, it's significant progress. And so in the months ahead, we have stressed to the bishop and his staff that you need to continue to make decisions. We need to find ways to announce reforms, put them in place, and to just keep moving forward on this. And so in this report, what we've done is we've picked and chosen few things initially, and I would describe the things that we are claiming that have been achieved to date as maybe more low-hanging fruit than other things. There are some thornier issues involved that require more careful thought and study. We understand that, but we're going to find a way to bring these onto the agenda of the joint implementation team, and then we're going to discuss how might we best address this. And we understand that, you know, despite the strong language here, not everything is going to be accepted, you know, exactly the way we proposed it. But I think there's room for a lot of discussion and a lot of positive action, because ultimately the faithful of the church need to be assured that while we continue to, you know, work towards issues of, you know, providing justice and reconciliation and healing to the victims of sexual abuse, and we've got a ways to go on how to do that better. I mean, it's not where it should be. But while we continue to work on that, we also need to address the organizational culture of the church and the diocese that gave rise to these things. And that's what a lot of this work is about. And it includes, you know, the formation of priests in the seminary and the general overall approach as to how do we view the laity's role vis-a-vis the ordained clergy, and what things are laity competent to do and should be entrusted to do, and how can they have a greater voice consistent with canon law and those kinds of things. So there's a lot here to be addressed. And so I've continued to say to people that this is not a short-term fix. We have to be committed to this for the longer haul, because we're talking about significant organizational change.
Transformational culture change.
Absolutely.
That's huge in the church or a corporation or wherever.
And as this document represents, it can be messy and chaotic at time. It can get passionate. You know, sometimes people will stray over the line, but you know, the bishop and I and others have, as we've talked about this, have remarked that, you know, you feel the Holy Spirit moving in this work, that something new is being created here. And so we try to put aside maybe personal reactions to things. And remember, we're talking about the institution of the church that we all love, and we're trying to get this to a good place.